hopefully we get better today. But even seeing you, like, I feel my immune system like getting stronger just by seeing you, you know? So
I was taking a trip down memory lane, and I was looking back to when we first connected on LinkedIn, Jason, and it was like right when everything was changing. It was like 2020, magical year. You were moving off, starting your own thing at Elevate. And I was looking at your LinkedIn numbers this morning, 27,000. Congratulations, my friend.
Thank you.
Tremendous. That's awesome. Number of followers. I'm 20,000 behind you. You have far surpassed me, and I'm so proud to be your friend and see like what you've done. And I even have your book. I'm just going to just gush all over you. You know, I've got my autographed Jason copy, and I was preparing for this interview and thinking about all the cool stuff you did. And you're such a, like a book bandit. You just crush, steal time from God knows where to publish these books. And yeah, I just noticed on this book on the cover, it says book one.
Yeah.
There will be more.
Yeah. That's fun. It's so Kate, every one of those images in that book, Kate did. So there's a lot of overprocessing in that one. Actually, I would make the image and sketch it. One of our lean tact engineers would then do it, and then Kate would turn it into a consistent format for all of the images in the book, because she said, don't write some boring lots of text book, Jason. People are tired of that. So it was really highly visual. That took a lot of time, but book two is tax steering and control, and then book three will tie into the integrated production control system, and I'm really excited about both of them. I just need to get started on the third. So
yeah, and I know you will. I absolutely know you will.
How's your book doing? That's you have a fantastic book, by the way.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that book is doing well. Every month I get an email from Amazon that says, congratulations, you will receive royalty payments this month. And I'm always like, I act the same way every month. I'm like,
oh my gosh.
It's been doing really well. It's been selling internationally, and US is the number one place, but also internationally. We've made it free on Kindle Unlimited the entire time. Notes from some folks overseas that Kindle Unlimited doesn't always work depending on what country they're in. So people, if you're listening out there, you're in some place and you can't get it, just message me. We'll figure out a way to get a copy your way.
Yeah, and if you message Felipe, you're in for a treat. He's a good guy. Are you still just as nice as you always were?
Always.
That's
still impressive. Every now and then find people that you blocked and make friends with them every now and then.
Oh, I've only blocked 7 people. It's not that big of a deal.
That's amazing. You take your sweatshirt off, your Lean Tech branded sweatshirt, and you have a Lean Tech polo underneath it.
Yeah, I love these. I think I've changed my tune with the arguing with people on LinkedIn. I think I'm more open to having empathy and connecting with people. There's a lot of grumpy people out there though. I've repented of my ways with that.
Well, we even have I would classify some of the friends that I have as being super grumpy.
Really?
And it's kind of weird. It's like they almost take on a different persona when we're on social media than when they're, you know, talking to you one-on-one.
Yeah.
I always think like, okay, they're wrapped up in the perceptions and their experiences. So they haven't had my experiences and they were just going to have a different take. And
yeah,
maybe I always say this now, Jason, I used to say, I always will learn something from them.
Yep.
And now I say, maybe I will learn something. So even I've softened a little bit the other way.
Yeah, that's funny. Well, the conversation I learned the other day that the reason people get so violent on and social media is because they don't have proximity. They can't see face to face, hug, touch, discuss, be around them later. They don't live in the same town, root for the same football team. And I thought, hey, that's something. It's really easy to get mad and other or demonize other people when you're not near them all the time. And it's probably just pretty natural. You know what I mean? So I'm a little bit more patient about it. So you're a good example for me.
Thank you. Yeah, I got up to it at my, when I was scheduling well and everything was good, I got to about 5 posts a day, which was crazy. It was crazy. Awesome. Good. I mean, it was so much fun, Jason, like, you know, what it is. But then, I'm realizing like, well, sometimes I would post because using the schedule, I couldn't react to people and have the dialogue back and forth. So like I took it back to about 2. And I think for me, the sweet spot is like 1 to 2 per day. That way, the right type of engagement.
That's awesome. Did you see a lot of results from that? Like more, so obviously you saw more people reaching out, more people implementing Scrum. That's awesome.
Ton more. I've been getting a lot more people that I've never met, never heard of. Like recently I was talking to somebody over the holidays about Scrum and what's the difference between like a registered Scrum Master, certified Scrum Master, and then like a professional Scrum Master. I'm starting to realize, man, there's a lot of Scrum competition training out there. So I was just saying, first, I always answer with, I'm biased because I'm a registered Scrum Master. I'm also a certified Scrum Master, and I maintain both credentials, but I'm a registered Scrum Trainer. So I'm biased towards whatever Scrum Inc. is doing because that's where my bread's buttered and where all innovation comes from and the patterns. And we co-created the construction design and construction Scrum course. So that when I tell people, like, as far as I know, there's no other design and construction course out there, but if you find it, let me know. So I'm biased saying that this one is the best one for you because we use examples, patterns, implementations, and experiences that are for us in our industry, others, because most of the other Scrum stuff is super heavy software and IT because that's where it's been for a long, long time. And we have even more case study examples, more people. And I still, to this day, Jason, you hold the record for most questions asked during and I had the last course that I taught this December, people were asking like, well, how many questions did Jason ask? And I said, you're not even halfway to where he was yet. So,
well, this Scrum is game changing. I mean, I'm preaching to the choir with you, but I didn't understand the things I needed to understand until I took your course. And in fact, would you mind if I shared a quick thought with you and see if you can lead me down the right road?
Yeah, let's do it.
So I was telling Hal this on a podcast just the other day. And by the way, full transparency, Kate hates this name. So we're going to have to rename it, structure it, and make it a concept that will stick. But I called it the bungee effect. And what it was is when we start to trade stack or trade burden and overlap our trades to where they're more, to where they're either stacked multiple people in one area or burdened where they're in too many areas, that because of that list that you teach in your course of you now are batching work, you have context switching, larger team size, additional complexity and communication. Now you're changing leaders, you're changing crew compositions. Now you're doing needless or unnecessary or useless onboarding. And then you stop installing work right the first time, which means you have rework. And then you stop looking out ahead for roadblocks, you stop removing roadblocks and your product. Oh, and then you start working overtime and there's this productivity spiral. And for anybody listening on the podcast, like when you overlap a day, that whether it springs back or springs back 2 to 3 days, when you overlap it, it'll bungee back because trades just can't do it. Right. And so those, I think I counted 14 of them, and they're all, for anybody listening, they're all concepts Felipe taught me. And then other lean people would say, well, they have always been lean. And Felipe and the group looped them into Scrum. I don't know what happened, but Scrum training is what taught me them. They spring it back. And I believe that if superintendents and people in the industry understood the bungee effect or whatever we want to call it, they would understand that it's not a viable solution for accelerating schedules. And even Scrum, which I love, by the way, we got Scrum everywhere at Elevate and Lean Tech. Scrum doesn't tell you to trade burden or trade stack. They tell you to, unless I have it wrong, to protect the team and to collaboratively use that Scrum board with your sprint planning and your review and your retrospectives. And so this is also a nimble system that does not hurt trades. And so when you hear that, and let me put you on the spot, Felipe, when you hear about that bungee effect, you name the tech production system. So I'm thinking, do you have a name for that? And here's my question. How can we get that popularized, marketed, or named in a way that everyone will, oh yeah, if you do that, you'll get the bungee effect. Or like, teach me.
Yeah. I'm not disliking the bungee effect. Sorry, Kate, but as you described it, so I mean, for people listening, I'm huge on context, and what Jason's talking about absolutely does happen. There will be times during a project where people make decisions to, to force trades into areas because they're available. It's a side effect of a low planning environment. The higher you plan, you would never sacrifice and push people into areas where they shouldn't be, because you know that it's going to take focus off of where you're planning to go. So you're going to delay your milestones. But people look at, and superintendents, I feel for you, all the superintendents out there, and I've been a superintendent, when you've got like 10 crews or 3 crews, or sometimes even just 4 people in front of you that need something to do, you want to not let them be at work being unutilized, because you've been trained. Everything in your training says, I have people, I've got to keep people busy. This is the mantra of most superintendents. It's unspoken. And so what Jason was describing is like something has interrupted your plan and you've decided to move people into areas just to make them busy. Like Jason described, putting people in multiple locations, doing all those things. What you've done is you've broken your plan, or you've adapted. You think you're adapting to do something well. Sometimes it's better to slow people down and say, okay, we can't, you know, do this. Stop. Let's replan.
Yeah.
Planning. And this is one of the scrum patterns that we talk about. So one antidote for what Jason described would be to bring the key people in. You don't have to bring in the entire job site. Bring the key people in and do a quick replanning. Sometimes you can do it between just 2 trades. Sometimes it's only just the issue of 1 trade. It's rarely the entire job site. Like the job sites are so big that people can continue working and make progress on the plan. But you might need to bring in 1, 2, maybe 4 of the trades. Maybe.
Welcome to the EBFC Show, the easier, better for construction podcast. I'm your host, Felipe Engineer Manriquez. This show is all about the business of construction. Today's show is also sponsored by the Lean Construction Institute. LCI is working to lead the building industry in transforming its practices and culture. Its vision is to create a healthy and thriving industry that delivers outstanding project outcomes every time for everyone. Check the show notes for more information. Now to the show.
Depending on like what type of, and Jason and I are on jobs from, you know, thousands of dollars to billions of dollars.
Yeah.
But like this works at the very large as well as the very small. Bring people in, do a quick planning. I'm talking like 20 to 30 minutes.
Yeah.
With the right people that can make decisions, unbungee the bungee cord. Because Jason's right. What's going to happen is that they're going to stretch out to make this temporary thing happen.
Yes, yes.
And they're gonna bungee back, and that bungee back is unpredictable, just like the bungee cord, Jason. So I'm doubling down on this bungee
effect. I love it.
It's gonna be the bungee effect, as coined by Jason Schroeder
and Sleep Engineer.
we're gonna promote this to show people what happens, and then when that bungee comes back unpredictably, you've lost flow on the job. So if you don't intervene and you let it just bungee back, and no matter what you think is going to happen, it will absolutely bungee back, because eventually they're going to get past that constraint, that bottleneck, and people are going to try to get back on plan, but they're going to try to do it by themselves, sub-optimized, because people's view of their work is just too narrow. It's by design with specialization. You can't overcome it. The only way to overcome it is to increase knowledge flow. And the only way you're going to increase knowledge flow, unfortunately, is to bring people in and have some kind of visual to represent the work, which is what I love. I'm a huge TAC fan. I mean, just even look at the cover of Jason's book. Just on the cover, the TAC, it's impossible not to see the structure in that TAC plan. And if you have something like that, or if you're pool planning using Last Planner system, or if you're using Scrum, and you know, I always say, if you're using TAC or Last Planner system, you're using versions of Scrum.
Yep.
And I say that all the time, and I show people, and so they know. I've got YouTube videos on this topic, not to the beauty of Jason's level, but I'm a huge Jason fan. But the bungee effect, to overcome that, increase the communication flow. So let people visually see what the new plan is after you've come through that. If you're in a bungee zone now and it's already shrinking back, you can still bring people in and replan and make it visual. Implement a TACT, or implement a small pull plan, or implement a small scrum to get through that hurdle, and then back tracking towards your milestone. And if you're on the job and you're not even like tracking towards a milestone within a 4-week span, then my God, go to Lean TAC's YouTube channel right now and start watching Jason's videos. Just binge watch all those videos. Go back to the earliest video and just binge watch them to the present. You've got to have a way to navigate and steer this project. Otherwise, the project steers itself. And when it steers itself, you're going to have a whole bunch of punch list work. And Jason, what you're describing, that bungee effect, let's not forget the second order consequences. So the first order consequences is that you're pushing people, burdening them. The stress for the workers is going up in the moment because you're now trying to make them be in multiple places at once or working with people too close to them, which creates danger and safety issues when you just pile too many people together. There are limits of space and how much space people need to do their work correctly at a high level of quality with pride. And if you crush people in or you force people into these tighter conditions where too many people are trying to be in too many spots at once, you're decreasing their ability to have pride in their work, decreasing their ability to be focused. You're increasing the chances of safety issues. You're definitely increasing punch list issues. And you're going to be on a job with lots of back charges. So you're making a ton of work for the management side after the fact to clean up what you're doing, you know, trying to do your best intentions in the field. This bungee effect has these second order consequences, third order consequences. Here's the third order consequence. If you do that enough as a pattern in the work that you're doing, your company is going to pay higher prices for work than is necessary.
Yeah.
So versus teams like that Jason and I work with, where we can reduce punch lists down to just handfuls of items because the quality goes way up when you can plan the work. And when people know where they're going to work, as Jason famously says, trade flow, logistical flow, workflow.
Yeah.
Cool me down, Jason. Say it. No. It's going to sound better.
Oh, sorry. Workflow, trade flow, and logistical flow. Yeah.
Workflow, like where are the trades going? Where are we headed towards? Where is the materials going any given day? Right. And where are the crews going day by day? So that you can see you've got a leveled work. What I love most about, and I learned how to level work way better in Jason's course, in his TAC training course, which I highly recommend to everybody. I became the TAC master with Jason. Jason taught me how to level crews in a very intuitive and easy way. And I think Jason, did you ever go to the Berkeley training that they used to do P2SL for TAC?
So we sent some of our engineers there to learn, and without sharing any of their tools, they shared the concepts. And that's primarily where we learned work density leveling.
Yeah.
And so we learned quite a bit from that course. Yes.
Yeah, I learned some basic stuff from that course as well. And then when I came to your course years later, it's like everything just unlocked. It was like just perfect unlocking, like, oh, I remember this from that course. And then when I saw like how you'd systematized it, it just seems so easy to do. I've even taken like the basics of like how to create a TAC plan and scrummed it. And I show people, here's how you do it. You take creating a TAC plan and just run it through Scrum. And then it's very easy to do. And Jason done a great job on his site with the TAC template. And it's like step-by-step guidance. Like even one of the pages on your TAC template workbook had like 6 or 7 steps, maybe 8 steps on the left side. And then you make your TAC plan on the right side.
Yeah.
I mean, you just can't make it any easier. People like Jason and I always joke, like even a bad TAC plan will outperform a good CPM schedule every day of the year.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bungee effect.
So, and I love that. The other thing I love is the unintended consequences, which you brought up, which I didn't have on my mind, and needs to always pair with the teaching of the bungee effect, is that if somebody was like, well, if I do stack, what are my exact consequences? Well, you don't know. Like that could be a long tail, like they say in the book, How Big Things Get Done. Like it.
Oh my God.
You
like, are you in my room, Jason? Because I got that book right here on my desk.
Oh, man. I'm like in love with that book. I'll just to say it. Everybody's just going to have to forgive me. I feel like in that book, they took all the things that we're talking about as lean influencers and was like, oh, well, let me just go ahead and do a study for you to prove that it's real. And I mean, it's like, oh my gosh, this is exactly what we're talking about. And the unintended consequence, I like that book because they say, you know, it can be up to 65% over on average. But in some cases, I think they had said 1,880%. That's 1,880% over what they had originally budgeted. And I'm like, I don't know, 1,880 is such a large number. I don't even have the skills to mention it in a percentage quickly. Like we always talk about 120, 200, 300. Well, I've never gone above 1,000 on a percentage. And so to your point, those unintended consequences that it will, this is actually kind of fortunate. I don't know what to say, but there was a little YouTube video. I was in a doom scroll on a plane because I wasn't feeling well yesterday on the plane. And I saw a video with a circle where the balls, there was two balls. And as soon as they hit each other, they would make another one, right? And then they kept going. And then the circle like jam packed because of this ripple effect. And when you start that productivity spiral, because of those things, it's just, it becomes exponential, just like the communication, the complexity of communication for team sizes. And I think that's important to realize that as soon as a superintendent does this to the point where it's actually going to compound, it could be exponential and very, very dangerous for the project. And then I don't know that we have proper anchors for how bad it can get. The other thing I hope everybody, I don't know if I'm batching too much information here, but the other thing that I hope everybody got was when you said it about quality. The other day I was working with a project team talking to them about their field engineering program and their self-perform work. And they're like, Jason, we need help making sure that our self-perform is perfect. Like, we work for an owner that will not tolerate one mistake. Now, we all know that that's unrealistic. When, you know, concrete cracks and we pay taxes, like those are the two certainties in life, right? But when in the past I would do field engineer training and that's it. Like, if we do better lift drawings, we'll have a better quality product. Or if we train the field engineers better for layout, we'll have better quality product. But I was wrong. We have to train the field engineers and the foreman and the workers, to your point, to pair together and to work within a quality system, like W. Edwards Deming says, to work within the system to create a quality product. And before that, to your point, the schedule has got to enable them to work in one piece, one process flow, which is another really, really huge thing that I learned from Scrum, is that really narrow in progress column. You're not the, and I was talking to the project team, I was like, guys, your crews will not, they will be incentivized by going, they will think that, they will try to go fast to incentivize because they're being incentivized to meet production. But what they need to do is work in one process flow and plan, build, and finish while they're there. And that's only going to happen within a system. And you pointed me, I heard you arguing with, I can't remember, but anyway, I've been reading a lot of Deming lately. Yeah. And I love that he says, quality is not, you cannot pin quality on the worker. It's your job, right? And I told them that. I said, we have got to create a system where, from a scheduling standpoint, the integration with the foreman, the huddles, like you said, getting the people together and making sure that the field engineers are there in support, that they can actually work in one process flow. And so when people think about quality, it's not a, oh, I would go fast, but I've got to go do this boring quality thing. No, you want to go fast, do it quality, like Felipe's talking about. So those are two really important concepts.
Yeah, you got to zoom back, and we're always, it's Jay Carroll. We always get into debates on Deming, and even to this day, he still baits me on LinkedIn every now and then. But Jake is a good friend of mine, and I know that Deming has influenced him. You have to be influenced by someone, even if you dislike them. So take that, Jake. You're super.
Well, what is the contention with Deming, if you had to guess?
You know, with him, it's just, he says that people blindly over rely on someone. And I was like, I'm not over-relying. And even I had another friend that said the same thing about Lean, that, you know, we'll get too crazy about Lean. And we've got I consider Bob Emiliani a friend. He's written just enormous, I think he's actually probably written as many books as you have, Jason.
He's written more, like four times as many. By the way, I get to interview him this afternoon.
Oh my God. Yeah. Congratulations. Yeah.
Small world.
Dr. Bob. You can tell him Felipe said, hi, Dr. Bob.
I will. Yeah. I will. I think I remember. So Hal Makomer said, I need to go talk to Bob and read Goldratt's Principles of Flow. Don't tell Hal, but I read the Principles of Flow before, and it was a little bit dry, so I didn't steal too much from it. But so I'm going to go back and read that and learn as much as I can from Bob. I think Bob did a couple of counterpoints on some LinkedIn posts, but I never blocked him. So you'd be proud of me.
Look, it's paying off, and I was going to be a content, I mean, he's a massive content provider on LinkedIn to talk content, but I think you know, people are not wrong to say we should not get over reliant on one or two thinkers in any given space. But I consider Deming even today one of my mentors. I never met him. He was, by the time I even realized he existed, he'd already passed away in the 90s. And so all I have are the books, right? Just like you do. We just have the books, and they've been very influential on me. A lot of the stuff that he wrote about is still true even now, especially I think he was very critical of Western management style. And, you know, when I say Western management style, a lot of the listeners might not even know what I'm referring to, and that's okay. You just check out that one of Deming's books. I'd say the first good Deming book to start with is The New Economics.
Okay.
Good first start. And Jason held up Out of the Crisis. That's a little thicker one. That's like more advanced Deming reading, but I'd say start with The New Economics. There's a lot of nuggets in there that talk about things like even just as basic as in the work that we do, no matter what kind of job you have, psychology is a big part of our work. I think a lot of people undervalue that. And even in your book, Jason, in the Art of the Lean Builder Tact Planning, book one, you have this big disclaimer in the beginning of the book about who this book is for. And then this book is to prevent people from becoming abusive with tact planning.
Yeah.
And I love that you put that in there. Like, that was a surprise. Like, I'm turning the pages and I saw that in the book and I thought, man, how thoughtful of you to put that warning in the book, because people do, especially in Western management, where it's not people are evil, but there's things in the system that incentivize people to behave in evil ways and to take advantage of people, even at the sacrifice of humanity.
Yeah.
People trying to do the work. And I think you and I have both been to many projects where the value for people, respect for people is really low. And I'm always amazed that people still show up to work every day with how they're treated.
Quality is really on management. You can't just go, because I went through the list, like setting clear expectations, communicating expectations, incentivizing on the job site, the quality control program, the ability to stop and get it right from the beginning. I went going through the list in one of the YouTube videos that I just recorded. It's like the workers and foremen aren't in control of any of these. Like, that's such an interesting concept to me. The other thing is, Kate, and I think I am too, but I just don't get very much time. That sounds bad. I don't take very much time to listen to Simon Sinek, but Kate is a huge Simon Sinek fan. And I was like, what's his main message? And she said, his message is to reverse the teaching, all of the teachings of Milton Friedman. And I was a little thrown by that, because back in the day, I was a huge Milton Friedman fan when it comes to like capitalism and socialism and economics and things like that. But there's one thing that Milton Friedman said was the purpose of a business is to make money. Simon Sinek, and it sounds like Deming, said the purpose of a business, if you're playing the infinite game, is to benefit humanity. And I really liked that clarification, because to your point, and this is actually a really good cue, because on the podcast, I've been talking, the books, The Triumph of Classical Management Over Lean Management, Straight Talk, How Google Works, Deming, they all say the same thing. When you get people in their ivory castle disconnected from the work, they have the money and the levers and the decision-making, but these are the people that know what needs to be done. You know, when you separate that, that's classical Western management, right? And you're making decisions and solving problems that don't exist. And so I think that's really well queued up for anybody that is at least listening on my end. And I think it's great. One of the things that I wanted to say, and so I hope I'm doing these one at a time and not batching too much, but there's a lot of lean influencers that get mad at each other for different things. And I thought, like, so Jake has a point, don't over rely on somebody. But in my opinion, we're doing exactly what those influencers or those authors or those experts were wanting us to do, right? If we take Nicholas Modig's work and Jeffrey K. Liker's work, and which I know Bob has a problem with, Bob's work and all these people that, you know, Deming, we're taking it and implementing it. And sometimes I see, and I'm not complaining, I'm not mad about this at all, but sometimes I see it's like, no, we're not sticking true to the original text, or you're sticking too much to the original text. It's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. We are implementing in the field with results and social media-ing the results of these systems and applying it. So the thought that comes to me, in my opinion, and I would love your perspective, I think we're doing exactly, maybe I'm wrong, maybe they wanted us to follow it exactly, but I was under the impression that we were doing exactly what they wanted us to do with this, is to implement. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. I think Deming famously said that you've got to, I mean, he talked about things from a theoretical perspective, and a lot of people misunderstood theory, and people forget, like, he was trained as a physicist. So he was a scientist first, and then he became somehow, I don't know the sequence of events that led him to becoming a management consultant, but he was a scientist first, and everything was based on experiments. Like, you do something, you observe what happens, then you adjust your course, and then you experiment your way to understand, because you're dealing in complex systems. And yeah, the language for complexity came later with some of the work by Dave Snowden, who wrote the Cynevan theory, which is Cynevin. That's how you spell it. It's a Welsh word. And so, like, the whole point of that is that if you're in a system that's not simple, this is where cause and effect are not easy to ascertain.
Yeah.
And you've got to experiment to see what happens, and then study your experiment to see, like, do I want this again? Do I want more of this? You've got to experiment. Deming was definitely pro experimentation. Get dirty with the tools. Liker was trying to understand at a deeper level what was happening at Toyota. And you know, Dr. Bob, he just wrote this on LinkedIn. I saw it this morning when I woke up. He had a post that was going viral on one of his posts talking about there have been no Toyotas for over 35 years. He said there are no new Toyotas. So, like, no companies with the system that performs at the level of Toyota have come into existence now in the last 35 years. And he's right. I don't see any companies coming to the marketplace at a level of Toyota sophistication. But at the same time, like, when Taiichi Ono invented the Toyota production system, it was hated for a long time. And it took him 25 years to implement it at the assembly plant. Like, he started off in the second tier suppliers, first and second tier suppliers, and then they moved him into the main manufacturing plants. And then over decades, he got the system implemented to what people reckon, to what Liker was studying now. So what Liker studied took an entire lifetime of somebody to implement and get stable.
Yeah.
And people don't recognize that. Like, they think it just happens. And there's people always crapping on the lean tools. Like, even Bob, in his post this morning, he said, you know, people will come to the lean tools, use the tools, and then if the tools don't work, people are like, well, lean doesn't work. Right. And he makes a really good argument for why, with, when you take a systems purview, like, it's not going to work. Like, I was training somebody, let me bring this concept to life. Jason, yeah, just
love it
so beautifully. I have a friend that I've known for 10 years, finally came to one of my scrum trainings. And this person always would say things that I knew they had a different belief about batches. And this, I'm going to focus this on just batches, just to prove this point. So, like, in lean, we learn, or if, you know, as some of our friends on LinkedIn will tell us, in industrial engineering, we learned that batch sizing plays a huge factor in your throughput of your system. The bigger the batch, the longer it's going to take you to do it. The smaller the batch, the faster you can flow through your system, the faster you can deliver what the client wants when they want it. So there's a right sizing to batching. And in your book, you talk about Little's Law, and you said one of the main ideas of Little's Law is making smaller batch sizes or right sizing the batches. Totally agree. And it's, you can't argue the science, and you can even get mathematical on it to show. Okay. Now, this person, their belief was bigger is better. Super common American belief. Like, just go to any restaurant and you can see, like, small, medium, large, extra large, supersize me examples all over. It's everywhere you go, like economy size, economies of scale. This is like the whole business model for Costco and Sam's Club and these big box stores that sell these huge bulk items. They tell you, like, it's cheaper. Buy in bulk, it's cheaper. And so we're conditioned as consumers in the United States to always think bigger is better. And the more I have of something, the better it is, the cheaper it is. And that's true, but you don't actually need all that stuff. And then you have to deal with, like, now I've got closets full of, like, big bulky stuff that I can't hang my coat up in the wintertime because I got toilet paper and paper towels, like, you know, to the ceiling. And I'm exaggerating how many paper towels.
Yeah.
And then I'm not that messy. We use cloth towels sometimes. But my point is, like, you have to deal with the inventory of having these huge batches. Like, as a family of three, Do I need to have 24 rolls of toilet paper? Like, what's going to happen in a 5-day week? And it's not like we live out in the woods, Jason. Like, I live in the suburbs. Yeah. I could go to a gas station if I need to and buy toilet paper from a gas station if it gets that dire, right? But we're buying these huge jumbo rolls because the price per sheet is so low because we're buying these massive quantities. But we don't take into account, like, I've got to haul it. I've got to store it. I've got to handle it. There's all these extra things I have to do. So I'm trading back off the savings in my labor, you know, versus being efficient, just buying just enough at the right amount so that I have a steady amount for what I need. If my cycle of shopping is every 5 days or every 6 days, if I'm doing it on Saturdays, which is typically what I do, I only need 6 days supply. Why am I buying a 1 month supply? Right. So like the superintendent, to bring it back, my friend, his thinking was bigger is better. Bring it all to the site. And so he's working on this project and he's like, I want to bring everything to the site. And I said, before you bring everything to the site there's an exterior sequence of work they were going to do. I said, how are you going to store it? How are you going to handle it? You're going to break. You're going to dip into your attic stock of the stuff because things are going to get damaged. You're going to handle things twice or more than twice. I've never seen people take big batches of deliveries and not handle it 3 times minimum. I think I end up handling it. And I said, you know who's paying for all that? You to run it, to manage it, just so you can feel like a little security blanket, like, oh, it's here. I feel better. No, it's here. Now you got to protect it. You got to account it. You have to account for it. And then what are you going to do when you start dipping into your attic stock? You're just going to tell the owner, like, we'll get you some later in the future. Now you're making your management team manage that. And he still said, I know. He's like, I'm doing it. I'd rather have it here than not have it here. And so he brought it, and all the things that I said would happened. They had to create an inventory. They had to handle it more than 3 times. It reduced the profit for that subcontractor. So fast forward, now he's coming to one of my Scrum courses. We get to the slide where Jason's talking about where we teach batch sizes and there's diminishing returns when you get to a certain team level, because even people can batch too. You get to a certain number of people, you spend more money, but you get nothing in return for the extra spend. Nothing. Then it happens, I think, somewhere between 10 to 17 people. Somewhere in between 10 to 17 people, they show in studies that you get no return for the extra people.
Yeah.
So you've got to change how you get the people together. Like Jason said, there's onboarding, you know, socialization. They call it the social debt, culture, norms, all these things factor in. So we're on the slide. I'm watching my friend, Jason. No change.
No change.
Crashing against his belief that more is better. If I had more people, I could do more stuff. But there's a limit, like we said, there's a limit of space, time, context of what people can actually physically be engaged in.
Yeah.
Even though in Scrum, we have this pattern of swarming where you can bring the whole team together and go after a problem, just like bees do on an invader to the hive to protect the queen. The same with tasks, but there's a limit to how many people can physically be on something.
Yeah.
And it's work dependent. It's task dependent. So I told my friend, like, I recognize this happening. I said, hey, this is that thing that I was talking about. Here's the data and the science. And I was like, I know the numbers will not compel you to change your mind. I said, you need to do an experiment, a small experiment, and just test this for yourself. And then we play this game where we batch with, you know, numbers. We create like 3 columns of stuff and we like this batch. And then we do one piece flow, and the one piece flow is always twice as fast. And even then the person's like, nah, it's just because of the game. I mean, that's how strong these beliefs are that people have. And so like Jason and I are saying, like, you need to have the experience yourself, and like us doing this on the podcast and explaining this to you, it's not going to make you change your mind.
Yeah. You
need to experience it firsthand. Like have a, you know, if you're on a construction project and you've never implemented lean, or you can't recognize lean stuff happening, you're likely on a job that has large batches.
Yeah.
Just check you want to see if you're on a traditional project, people listening to the show, go to your last 2 schedule updates and look, find a milestone in the schedule that was in the next 6 weeks. And if you see that milestone in the second update move to the right, taking longer,
yeah,
congratulations, you're in a traditional schedule.
Yeah, exactly.
You've got your batches are too big. So like Jason and I, we look like ninjas or like magicians coming into your projects to create flow. What we do is we reduce batch sizes, increases throughput, we gain schedule time, and then people are all like, oh my God, lean is so magical. Like, it's really basic principles that we're applying, these patterns. And it's quite easy because 99.9% of all construction projects are big batching, because everything in your everyday environment says bigger is better. Like, yeah, you know, if small microphones are good, why not get a bigger microphone, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Or, and it, the same thing happens with cranes too. Everything bigger is better. But
yeah, everybody wants the super giant crane.
We hear all the time that building enclosure is the number one problem in construction. And when the task of the building enclosure is presented with so much pressure, it's something most of us would want to avoid. Until now, there has never been a course to teach someone how to manage a building enclosure. Building enclosure is a problem for every company, and the solution is often to ask someone within to try to find training or provide training to their teams to avoid these issues. Field Verified's enclosure management course is the answer to that problem. We learned the hard way. We've learned through failure. We've learned from others. This course, our team, will help those people who are assigned to manage the building enclosure be successful the first time so that they're spared some of the suffering and hardships that all of us went through. There's so much opportunity for a high return on investment, not just when an individual attends and all of the skills that they'll achieve, but when a team participates together, they can raise their level of performance by knowing what each other can do, what to expect, and they can raise the level of performance of that company as their careers excel and the company elevates along with them. The training is built on the science of how people learn. We capture all of the components that are necessary to master a skill. There's a hands-on component to the training where we're building a masonry mock-up, a metal panel mock-up, we're doing EIFS, and even installing a window that later you get to test. The hands-on training gives us the opportunity to translate the lines on paper to actual construction in the field. We always laugh because after the training, people come up and say, you know, this isn't just about building enclosure. There's a lot of leadership in here. There are a lot of people skills. That's because those skills are necessary to be successful in building enclosure and in construction. We'd love to see you get started right away. We have lots of options available. They can come to us in person at Field Verified in Phoenix, or we can bring the entire operation to your facility and train up to 25 people at a time. And we've created an online training that's available for people who might not be able to attend in person. Go to the website and contact us. We're going to start by understanding what problems you're currently experiencing and develop a specific program that's right for the needs of your company.
Yeah. For no reason. So the one job I did, and the concrete company suggested this. It wasn't my idea, but he said, we can bring out two smaller tower cranes and save a lot of money. We saved $360,000 by going to two smaller cranes. And our productivity was amazing. You know, one of the things that you mentioned, they, in their world, they may be right. Like your friend, if they're in a complex system where the owner is incentivizing bringing out all the material. And you said this, so I'm not adding anything that you didn't already say, but if the owner's like, yeah, I want it all here, and this is how we do things on this campus, or when you work for us, or we don't want smaller batch sizes, or, you know, the contractors we typically work with have larger zones. We want you to do the same thing. And I don't know if the word socioeconomic is the right one for explaining this, but if your friend is always working with in a complex system that incentivizes him to do that, he may be right isn't the right term. Meaning he may be right that he is incentivized to do that, but to your point, it's not right if the goal, which actually, oh my gosh, my mind blown. If the goal was to produce and you keep saying the shortest overall throughput time, then you're right. Like, you smaller batch sizes, right? And that I just realized that, like, when we read books like The Fifth Discipline or Systems Thinking in Systems, one of the key components or levers is the goal of the system, right? And you also mentioned classical management or Western classical management. The goal of the system is not to produce. The goal of the system is for each separated, and you said this word as well, sub-optimized department to look as best as they can in which case he may be being asked to bring out everything all at once. Okay, so what I'm going to do in the future, if I get a situation like that, what I'm learning is I can separate the truth of the goal of a production system, which goes back to TPS, but from what they may be incentivized with, and really connect and be like, in your system, the goal of your system that you're in on your project, that may be correct. You are right. If you want to change the goal to producing and respecting people, then we will have to do smaller batch sizes. Do you think that would work, Felipe, or what do you think?
I think that would work. And, you know, if you're on the job, Jason, you're talking to him, be like, yeah, we're going to do what Jason says. I've called that the Jason effect. I got to bring Jason to a job one time, and like Jason said the exact same things that I said, almost word for word. But when Jason said it, Jason was right. And people were like, oh yeah, like Jason's a genius. And I was like, yes, he is. And I just was there cheerleading you, Jason, because I wanted them to try something different, and bringing you there definitely did. So you unlocked for a lot of people. You have a good way of getting people to try something different. And I think we have the same talent, but you know, when we're both together, I call it the Jason effect. People, what Jason says, it's like getting people, and you're totally right. I forgot about the, you know, that's the good systems thinking that you said. If, what is the, and then I'm thinking of my friend now, like now, and you said it, he has been incentivized to do this stuff because that's getting rewarded. It makes the owner happy because the owner's used to the same thing. They're all used to the same type of thing. And on that campus, they did this over and over and over again.
Yeah. Yes.
And so it's getting reinforced, rewarded, and it's positive. And you know, people laugh, and we've gotten into fights, not you and I, but with other people. And I've said this, and people always like, that's not true. Here's the thing I'm going to say. People always say, sometimes projects don't want to finish early or on time. And everyone always tries to say, schedule is so important, but it's not true. It's not true. If schedule is really important, it doesn't match the behaviors that people take.
Yeah, but like, yeah, exactly.
Right. There's so many projects we go to, Jason, where people tell you everything they say is that schedule is the most important thing. Production's the most important thing. But then you walk their job and you're like, there's no way it's the most important thing.
Yes.
They're doing things on purpose. They don't know it, but they're doing things on purpose to slow production down.
Yes.
Less quality, to make it dangerous environment. And it's not the most important thing. There's other things that are important. And like Western management, I think we're nailing something now. And you can ask Bob. I think one of the main functions of Western management is to keep people busy all the time.
Yes. Yes. That's exactly it. I was thinking the exact same thing when you, so very few hit on the point that you just hit. You're right. It's not the goal. It's not the goal. The goal was to show that you can implement as much as you possibly can from your PMP certification, be busy, and show the owner that you care through busyness.
Yeah.
That's it. Okay. And when you were talking earlier, I was like, why, and this sounds really arrogant, I don't mean it like this, but why have I, Jason Schroeder, been so successful on projects as a superintendent, and you as well? So I'm just talking about my experience. But if you think about it, all of the system components were there. I had experience. I had the training. A staff that I knew from the book, How Big Things Get Done. There was five people that I had worked with before and trained that were loyal to me, an owner that was supportive of lean systems, a workforce and trade partners that were committed through contracts and relationships to the project itself, and all other supportive elements. And so when I go implement, I had all those things, right? And I do understand. And I'm getting more mature the project that I just visited the other day during my Christmas break. I went there and they had everything. They had the trailer, they had the team, they had the experience, they had the background, they knew their plan, they had the best self-perform work. But the owner dictated, you will do CPM by the book. You will not try and optimize your zoning. And it's like, well, okay, well, what do you guys want from me? Like I flew out here, you're not gonna go any faster. And it's funny, Felipe, they said the exact same thing that you said, which is really funny. They said, we've done multiple projects like this and we track them. This is our template plan. Boom, let's shove it in your face. And I can't help but feel that, and I may be wrong, but when I read the Deming, and I'm not through all of it, and I probably don't even understand most of it because I'm not on other people's or your level, but I can't help but feel that what they did in Japan was to change the socioeconomic conditions and realize that they were in a crisis. That's the title of the book, obviously, and were intrinsically motivated to work together, network, and really do this right. And I love what you just said. Even then, it took them 25 years.
Yeah.
And so very sympathetic. In fact, Kate the other day was like, and I don't know if we're going to do this or not, so nobody freak out, but we get asked to do a lot of training. I probably just did 30 training proposals over the last couple of weeks. And Kate was like, we're not going to do training for anyone who doesn't automatically do Tact, Loss, Planner, and Scrum. It's just not a thing. And she's the CEO, so it's her job to, you know, throw out the entrepreneurial radical ideas, right? But she's like, because we can go train you all you want. If you don't have the right systems, if you don't have the right buy-in and leadership, we're wasting our time. And that's our brand too. That was her argument. And I was thinking, like, that is a really good point. Like, are you in? Or, and I know this sounds dictatorial, and I talked to Jen just the other day. I need to get better with this, but like, are you in? Because if you're in, to your point, it's not just the tools, it's not just the training. We have to change the overall system. And I know that was a lot of concepts there, but I really feel like if I look back listening to some of the things that you were saying, I was successful with Lean. You were successful with Lean because we had all supportive systems within the complex system itself. What do you think of that?
I completely agree. And I even thinking of some of the times where things missing, like I've had feedback from project teams say, well, you can get results that we can't get. And like, what's the difference? Like, well, some of the difference is my attitude. So like with the workers, like my attitude towards the frontline workers is totally different. And when I say the workers, I'm even talking about design professionals as well. Engineers and architects, the way that I talk to, it's kind of funny. Like if you put a camera on my shoulder, Jason, and you filmed how I talk to architects and engineers and how I talk to trade people, it's almost identically the same, except tradespeople, it's a little bit more foul language, just a little bit, not much more. But I think like I empathize with the people that actually have to do the work. And I tell them like the goal of what we're doing is not to make you busy 10 hours a day. Because that's not helpful. Sometimes you need to do nothing. And I say, I'm not advocating for like nothing, but I'm advocating for like doing work that's needed, that's valuable, that people actually want.
Yes.
That makes you proud to what you want to do. And like, and you actually accomplish something. And so for like the workers, it's super easy. They buy in real fast because they're like, oh, this guy's not going to waste my time. Because so many other people waste their time. Project teams, most of the time it's you, general contractors, wasting the trade's time and money. And like, they don't have infinite time and money to just be at your beck and call and do whatever you want. So stop power tripping and start working with people to accomplish your goals. You're going to have more power than you know what to do with because your results are going to be so incredible.
Yes.
Really easy to get good results when you prioritize people first. And like Jason, you said it in your tech book, like everything that happens through these systems, it's people that make it happen. So if you prioritize the people, use processes to enable the goal. And like at some point you need to turn these buildings over so they can be used beneficially.
Yeah.
So no one's going to fight you on that. There's no fighting on that.
Yeah.
Even clients that like seeing people busy, take the time to walk with the client through the site, educate them so they can see the difference. And you can go get some contrast, go see something that's traditional, go see something where they're starting to optimize using TAC, using Scrum, using Last Planner system. Those project sites look and feel totally different.
Yes.
There's tons of contrast. And then you can implement those patterns. They're really easy to do. And you can start to get some of those things to be more successful. Like everybody listening, you only have so many hours in the day. Mm-hmm. You only have so much energy to put into things. So use it well so that you get more of what you want. Stop unnecessarily suffering.
I agree. You know, one of the things that's been on my mind, like last night I was talking to Kate and I heard Mike Rowe talk about, and I don't know if these numbers are correct, but I saw a little YouTube clip of Mike Rowe saying in the United States, there are 4 million, which is a lot because I think we only have 380 to 420 million people
right
in the United States, but 4 million younger, meaning like 18 to 30, I'd probably 18 to 30 year old people who can work, who do not have jobs and are not looking for jobs. And I was really, so like when I look at the book Out of Crisis, I'm like, people talk about that we're, you know, we have a problem in our industry, all industries in the United States and probably around the world, I'll say the United States need to hire more people, but can't hire more people. And I can't help but feel that the Japanese knew they were in crisis, but we don't. And I could be wrong. I'm just saying, like, if we think it's bad now, I think it's going to get much worse. And Helmeco Mercedes is hopeful, but I think it's going to get even worse. And Kate was talking to me about housing, like for our kids. Well, I'm starting to use my kids as an example. And we've got two kids at home that are 18 and 20, hardworking kids going to school, but they have zero intention of leaving the house. And Kate and I have zero intention of kicking them out. Now, some people might be like, well, you're a bad parent. And I would say, yeah, well, what took you so long to figure that out? Number one. But the bottom line is, at least in Phoenix, I can't think of a job that they could get while going to school where they could pay for or even find a house or pay for it. Because at least in our area, these houses have been bought for Airbnbs, or there's a shortage now. It's all centered in multifamily, and even that rent is somewhere around $1,800 a month. And the wages have not, in all cases, have not paced the cost of housing. And so Kate was like, even if you had a workforce that wanted to go work, even if you motivated them, even if you fixed construction, how are they going to leave the nest to go buy a house in most of these cities in the United States? And she said, because Jason, I would consider it irresponsible for us to kick out our two oldest kids, knowing that they're getting straight A's in school, but there's no math that ends up with you can afford your own place right now, right? And so then she said this, and I don't know how true it is. I'm just saying this is what's on my mind, is that if you're not forced, like our parents were like, get out, right? You and I don't know if your parents did the same thing, but for me, they were like, you're 18, you're out. If you want to stay, you're going to work, you're going to pay rent, you're going to be in a curfew. And I was like, F that. Like, I'm not, there's zero chance I'm doing these things. I'm out, right? And my first apartment was going and living in a little guest house for my first boss. But Kate's like, you can't, if there's no motivation to go fly on your own, right, until 25, 28, 30 years old, then where's the motivation to go into some of these trades, right? I can just stay at home for 6, 7, 8 years and go to school and then just get a job at Google, right? So I am a little panicked. And maybe this shows my bad character on my part, but I'm a little panicked because the way we treat people is a component in the complex system that's hurting us. The way we're teaching kids in high school is hurting us. The COVID-19 and people knowing that some of them that they could subsist off the government or didn't have to go to work is hurting us. The housing crisis is hurting us. And now it's a what do they call that, Felipe, where self-reinforcing feedback loop, right? Yeah. So we don't have enough people to build in construction, so we don't have enough housing. A lack of housing is feeding the fact that we don't have enough workers, which is then feeding that we don't have enough housing. And these things are starting to spiral. And we're being stubborn in the United States about immigration. I don't want to get on that topic and take this episode of the podcast and make everybody mad. But like from a data standpoint, and recruiters are only accepting people with construction management experience, and they're not accepting folks from other industries like veterans or police and these other folks. So we've got at least 10 major, what would you call them, system components that are working against us, and they're all in self-reinforcing feedback loops. And I'm a little bit panicked. And why did I say this? Oh, because I think the point that I'm getting from this conversation and from you is that we are going to have to start making, I know what it was, structural changes to our socioeconomic conditions, circumstances, and the system itself. And like you're talking about, when you have those projects with the perfect storm, we've got to get in there and show those as example projects and start to scale. And I'm sorry, that took way too long, but
Beautifully, Jason.
Okay. Well, I am a little bit panicked. Like for 3.5 years, you and I have been doing everything that we can. And by the way, the same thing happens with me where people are like, Jason, I don't understand you, but Felipe says it's good. You know, same thing happens to me. So I appreciate your partnership and your friendship and your love. And miss me some hugs. We've been doing this for 3.5 years with a lot of hopefulness. And we still have that hopefulness. I do believe we're probably in a worse situation than we think. And the last thing I want to say, like somebody was talking last night, what if Russia continues? We have a conflict with China and Iran and in Israel. We no longer, in my opinion, Hal told me this. Let me just not say it myself, but repeat. Yeah. We no longer have the logistical economies of scale or the ability to produce like we did in World War II. Like I was listening to, and this is just his name, please don't get mad at me, but there's a YouTube channel, it's called The Fat Electrician, and he tells war stories, and he's just amazing. It's the only YouTube channel other than Felipe's that I'll actually watch. And he was talking about the Berlin airlift. You remember that story where the amount when the Soviets blockaded Berlin in order to take over, the Allied forces started shipping in supplies to keep West Berlin fed. And they had to land a plane pretty much every minute. And they said if in a day, it would be like them airlifting 38 full-size blue whales into the Berlin airlift. It was the largest logistical and humanitarian feat ever recorded in the history of the world to their knowledge, right? And I was just thinking to myself, like, do we have that logistical ability today to produce? Do we have the logistical ability to produce in the United States if we did go to war? Do we have the logistical ability to even support our electrical grid, our services, our, you know, any of the systems infrastructure in our cities? And I was in Canada, in Vancouver, and they said in Canada, the World Bank of Canada did a study that if they doubled their production for multifamily housing or any housing whatsoever, in the next over 8 years, doubled, the number that they're at now, doubled, they would barely keep up demand for housing in Canada, and that the numbers aren't very much different in the United States. So I'm a little bit panicked. What would you say to that?
And so all that were, you know, sometimes Jason, I indulge in a little losing hope myself, just as a thought experiment. I learned from Deming, like use some theory. When you think back of systems thinking, yes, there are reinforcing feedback loops, but there are also loops outside the system that influence the system. And the things that we're doing with social media, with talking about respect, sharing our experiences, are absolutely those types of things that disrupt the system that's there. And I think the crises that happen, like when America was thrust going back into history, like World War One, World War Two, you know, you can look back at history and you can make the argument that we tried to stay out of the war, get into war, whatever, but we didn't have production in place to the levels that we did through the war and then ending the war. All those things were changes that happened when people recognized we were in crisis. We had to get into crisis. And I think you're right in saying most people don't recognize that things are not good.
Yeah.
Jason, all the things that you said about the housing, the education, the even thinking about your kids, like kicking them out, not kicking them out. These are problems that everybody has in this country.
Yes.
And that, you know, it's like on your mind. And if you don't step back and see all of it together, you think like, oh, I go to the store, I go to work, everything's okay. I read the news that I want to get. I get my own news, my own echo chamber, and everything's fine. But it's not. When you systematically look at what's happening, like there are indicators that we're in a decline.
Yeah.
And people are like, well, so can you be still be hopeful. And I'm still hopeful because people are waking up every day seeing that we're in a decline and they're not just standing still.
Yeah.
They're out there doing it. Like, you're out there doing it. I mean, I'm out there doing it. I'm doing the work every day in the way that I can.
Yes.
And I'm not trying to say like I'm super special. Like, everybody out there who's a change maker, like, you do it in your own little sphere. And if you stand and say like, I'm going to change this, like what I can control, then you're contributing to making it better. And you're not just declining with everything else that's declining. Like, one of the things we learned, like in all these like experiments that we do, have so much capability to make change.
Yeah.
We can co-create with changes that are happening, and we can adapt into any environment. Like, the human animal is by far the most adaptive animal on the planet. No other creature on Earth, except for, you know, simple creatures like bacteria and insects, are in all biospheres. We're in every single climate. We're like, we even shouldn't be in like Antarctica, like, but we can manage to ship things in and keep all those scientific bases operating. So like, we're everywhere on Earth, and like, because we're highly adaptive. We're in deserts, we're in the rainforests, we're in cities, we're in suburbs, we're in farmland.
Antarctica.
We're in Antarctica. We're on the ocean. There's people living on the oceans. We have people living in space, on space stations for years at a time. Like, we're everywhere. Our capability to adapt is phenomenal.
Yeah.
I think that always gives me hope, just thinking like how adaptive we are. And you can get used to things.
Yeah.
Like, the decline is so slow that you just get used to it. And you don't realize like where it is until you look back or recognize like, is your situation getting better or worse? And I think, you know, for people listening, if you change what you know and you experiment, like Jason and I are talking about with these concepts, you can create an environment and then expand your network with people to get a network effect. I think the network effect, recognizing like everyone that I put the moniker changemakers on social media are people that I'm recognizing are doing this network effect. And when we together and band together, and I am like fiercely protective of the people that are change makers.
Yeah.
Because every day is not a great day for us. Like, you're actively trying to implement changes and make something different. We're going against the system. It's going to be difficult. It's going to be hard. Yeah. And there's going to be things when you take an action, there will be an equal and opposite reaction for what you take. And some people can't withstand the pushback and blowback from trying to make these changes. And that's why, if you're listening out there, you're not alone. Like, Jason's here, I'm here, and there's thousands of us, billions of people like us, that we can stand the blowback and pushback and those first order consequences and say, we're still going to make positive change anyway.
Yes, I agree. You know, the other thing, so you're so right. Thank you for that. That's just what I needed today. Maybe I just get a little sad when I feel sick, but.
Maybe you just call me more often. Like,
yeah. Well, I was getting out of the truck in the airport, just feeling a little sad about it. And then I thought, as I was stepping out to go to Irvine, I was thinking to Riverside, doesn't matter. But anyway, as I stepped out, I was like, well, if it does go bad, we're safe, because there's no way they're not going to need us, you know? So all the change makers, what I hope is, after listening to you, you know, everybody, every system, every person needs three things, right? The knowledge, the motivation, and the circumstances to make real change. And I, to your point, the change makers, everyone out there, people listening to these podcasts, have the knowledge, they have the motivation. And when they have the circumstances, because the overall socioeconomic system is motivated to change, we'll be ready. I like it. So I just hope that we don't have to be motivated as a country or as an overall industry or as a system from a massive emergency that hurts people. I hope the motivation comes in a more palatable way. But my fear would be is that this might be a little uncomfortable. But, you know, hey, to your point, our country always responds and rises to the occasion when there's a need. So that's going to be realized one of these days. Thank you, Felipe.
Hey, welcome, Jason. You know, we're highly adaptive. I mean, even if you and I, when we first started tangoing, you know, when we were talking, we were both at crossroads when we first started talking, and we had to like jump into the unknown and then take some risks. And I think, you know, that's the difference between us. Like we look back, I'm looking back. It was 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Like 4 years ago. I can do my math right.
It was three. But you're spot on.
It was 3 years ago. And, you know, you look at the jump that you made, you literally leaped into the abyss and you just had an intuition. Like, I know what this is. I could just keep doing this and you would have been fine. Or I can jump and do this, something different, and maybe I'll be fine. And I was telling you, jump.
Yeah. 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 Very good. And I appreciate it.
Yeah. And I said, like, even if you jump, like, you're going to be fine because I'm going to always be here and you're always going to be here for me. And that's how I feel. Like, we have so many people that support us, and I can't even do this show and not mention, you know, one of our best friends, Brian Melcher. Brian has been like incredible to support us, both of us. And every time Brian and I talk, we always talk about, like, how's Jason doing? Like, and we're worried about you, and we think about you like a brother, like we should, like we care.
Yeah.
Care. Worry is not the right word. It's caring. Right. So like, even like now, as you're fighting this cold, and I'm telling you to drink some tea, and maybe that gets edited out. But I think I've told Jason like 7 times on this show to drink some hot water.
Yeah, I'll do it.
But that's my point. Like, we care. And I think, you know, when you look at all these things, especially when you look at the news and what's happening in the world, like even in World War II, there's stories of like during the Christmas soccer game that they played in, World War I in trench warfare, like people put their weapons down and it was the holidays and they got overcome by the holiday spirit and they stopped fighting and they played games. And to me, that's like, that's a signal that yes, we can do terrible things to each other, but we equally can do amazing things to each other and treat each other well. We have the capability for both.
Yeah.
It boils down to a choice. Like, you can decide, how do you want to be? Do you want to create good, spread love, or do you want to be like just insular, taking care of yourself? And I've got a teenage son myself now, Jason, and I tell him, like, you know, one thing I've learned over my lifetime is that these emotions that we feel as we experience things, depending on your circumstance, like in the moment, you think like it's just all this one thing.
Yeah.
Reality, it's limitless. Like, our capacity, like, to feel anger can go really high, but our capacity to feel love and care for others can go really high. It's really kind of infinite. It goes way beyond what you think.
Yeah.
Like, you can just choose. Like, I just decide a couple things. I decide, here's a personal belief mantra that I'm teaching my teenager. I will decide that no matter what situation I find myself in, I'm going to turn it to my advantage so that I can benefit and continue to move on, continue and not get stuck. I'm going to let things flow. I'm going to prioritize flow and then take advantage of any circumstances I find myself in.
Yeah.
Like, does that mean I don't feel feelings? No, I'll feel the feelings, but then let them flow through me and then decide how I'm going to proceed.
Yeah.
And so it takes time. So like, I mean, when you look at me, and my son's always like, well, he's like, sometimes you get upset and mad, but he's like, nothing ever gets you down. Like, every day is a good day for you. And it's like,
yeah,
it's this practice and this belief, and the belief reinforces the practice. And then it just makes it easier to navigate as things happen. And it's choice. Like, first it's a choice, then it's a practice. And then, you know, people even have said about Mike Rother, who studied Toyota for a long time, and he published some books with other folks, like learning to see like a different type of value stream mapping. And I think Mike has famously said it's easier, or maybe I'm just giving Mike Rother credit that I shouldn't. Like, it's easier to act your way into a new way of thinking than to think your way into a new way of acting.
Oh, wow.
It might've been like John Shook, now that I'm thinking about it, from Lean Enterprise Institute, but either way, it's, if you do it and you'll get some time to reflect about what you're doing, that can reinforce more of the doing.
Yeah. I love it. So be present. I love that. Be
present. Yeah. I just want to say, like, Jason, it's been amazing having this time with you and talking and then sharing this conversation with everybody. So I just want to super thank you, all the listeners listening. Like, Jason is my brother from another mother. I love Jason. And so I want you to remember that, Jason, as you're traveling throughout the world, there's at least one person out here. I've got the pom-poms. I'm cheerleading. You go.
I feel the same way. I hope that people, when they go to your scrum course, tell them, when it happens this way that I was the one that pointed them there, but I tell everyone, you got to do it and much more. I learned so much from you. So Felipe, thank you. This has been awesome.
Same. Jason, and when I tell everybody, like, I've had people ask me, like, well, how much tact do you show? I was like, well, I show a couple examples from Jason, and I always recommend take Jason's tact course. It'll change your life forever. And it's like Scrum friendly approved.
Yeah. You know, we learned those mural board techniques from your mural. That's really awesome. I love it. So, all right. I love it.
Thank you so much, Jason. You know what we're going to say now at the count of three, Jason, right?
Yep. I know what it is.
You count it down. We'll say it.
1, 2, 3. On we go. I love it. That's awesome.
All right, I'm going to stop this recording.
Thank you so much, Felipe.
Very special thanks to my guest. I'm Felipe Engineer Manriquez. The EBFC show is created by Felipe and produced by a passion to build easier and better. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, everybody. Let's go build.